to say a torso. You know what? A torso. A fucking a torso.
You take a sit because I have a stomach ache.
Your tummy hurts.
I have a bad tummy ache and I hate it.
All right then. Well, all right.
You got it.
I got this. Yeah.
You got this because the guy who usually does radio voice is out because he has too much of a tummy ache to do radio voice.
That's right. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Bottleman with Riley and me, Dan. Today it's just the two of us, and we're here to answer a burning question. Why does Riley have a tummy ache?
Why do I have a tummy ache? I hate it. I hate when my tummy hurts.
Why does your tummy hurt?
Britain opened up its pubs yesterday, and I got really excited, and I drank a lot of beers. I drank a ton of beers, and I was really enjoying myself, and I thought that nothing could possibly go wrong. And I came home. I woke up and I was like, ooh.
Oh, ow. Ooh.
Oh, no. My tummy.
I want to ask, did anyone help you out? Because I know just from experience, you know, sometimes when a man has a tummy ache, no one will come to his rescue.
Yeah, no, it's part of my job is being the most persecuted Canadian living abroad is nobody helped me with my tummy ache. No one called. I told all my friends about it and they kicked me out of the group chat.
This is brutal. So unfair. The most punished man.
Everyone hates me, and I think it's really unfair, and that I hate how my stomach feels even right now. And I want to go home, and I want to go back to what I was doing this morning, which was watching, like lying sideways in my bed, trying not to move my iPhone so it would reorient upwards, and just watching endless what turned out to be a 25-part series on YouTube of two Southern guys, in America, like they sound like they live in Georgia or something.
Yeah.
Buying a Lamborghini Huracan that was like totaled by a drunk lady in Florida, and then just like methodically repairing and restoring it. Yeah, it's really cool. And I really enjoyed it, and it's great tummy ache TV. And I think that those guys would be there for me, actually. I have a parasocial relationship with them now.
They would rub your tummy and ask you if you were feeling better. You know, they'd give you maybe like warm seltzer water, tell you to eat something greasy. Well, okay. Hated even more than you. What Canada hates even more than you and your tummy is communism. And that's mm-hmm. what we're here to talk about today.
Yeah.
We're talking about one of my favorite topics, which is Maple Gladio, the Northern Spider Network, Canada's importation of fascists post-World War II, and how they not only changed the political landscape of this country and shaped public opinion here, but also used Canada as a base of operations to spread their message to the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's one of these things, right, where after the Second World War, the U.S. does Operation Paperclip, and we're like, no nerd shit. We want the jock fascists in Canada.
We don't want your scientists. We don't want to benefit from the fruits of Nazi research. We just want the pure, uncut ideology.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We want people who are. We don't want anyone who worked on a rocket or anything. We want the guy. We want just someone who, like, I don't know, like made speeches in Croatia or whatever.
Yeah,
that's who we're interested in.
We want the guy who edited the newspaper that would tell you how to recognize Jews in Krakow. You know.
Yeah. You know what? I think that guy's genes have real promise for liberal politics. I assume someone related to him probably could rise pretty high up in the Trudeau administration.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That's just a wild guess.
High hopes.
That's just a wild guess of my part.
High hopes. So Canada has acted kind of like a petri dish for post World War II fascist diasporas, and we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is anti-communism? That's something I want to talk about today. And how do all these fascists keep ending up being supported by our liberal democracy?
Mm-hmm. Now, what the hell? I was told that was a liberal anti-communist organization that was against totalitarianism in general. There are a lot of fascists in it, which is, I think, unusual based on what they said. These kinds of organizations say that they're all about.
Yeah. So we're going to get into, and I think this is going to become a series, but we're going to, because there's so very much of it to go over. But we're going to get into why Canada is so successful at this. So we have a long history of successful government supported anti-communist actions, from using newly imported demobilized Ukrainian Nazis to help seize property assets from domestic Ukrainian socialist organizations, which is a thing that happened in the 1950s here, to weaponizing Hungarian fascists to undermine the union at the massive Inco nickel mine and smelter in Sudbury.
So I have a question, actually, right from the beginning, because this is something that I don't know as much about as you do, right? And one of the things I'm interested in uncovering here is, like, what were the mechanics of how, because as I understand it, there are a lot of the, especially like Eastern European populations in Canada and Central Canada, like Saskatchewan, whatever, these are relatively, like, originally, these are very sort of like left-wing immigrant groups, a lot of heavy unionization and stuff.
Yes.
What is the mechanism by which these property assets are seized or these unions are undermined? Like, how do we get from a Waffen-SS division in Latvia or whatever to strike breaking in Alberta?
Well, so when you have like a restive population of pro-labor organizing that is confined to like a single ethnic group, right? Like, and I think the Ukrainians are the best example of this. When you have a Ukrainian diaspora that's been in the country for 60 years, say, and they start building labor temples and start offering things like workers' health care outside of their own diaspora group. So they start saying, you don't have to be Ukrainian to work here, but it sure helps. No, they say, you know, it doesn't matter if you're part of our community. We believe in workers' rights. We believe in medical care for anyone who's in our class, essentially. When you have that in a country that depends on resource extraction, then you have kind of a problem.
Yeah. Okay. Understood. So there's this requirement then to, like, so you wanted to, so basically you're a company, you're looking at what is essentially workers organizing along, like, national lines. So, like, you know, Ukrainian workers organizing with Ukrainian workers, and then that spreading beyond a Ukrainian community. Mm-hmm. You see an opportunity, basically, oh, we're going to disrupt this. So then how that happens is then the company will go and hire like an SS division to take over the night shift at the factory.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the best ways to erode sort of solidarity in these communities is to import recently, like, displaced fascists. So, so again, and we'll cover this in our upcoming episode on Ukrainian Canadians and Chrystia Freeland with Yasha Levine. That community is maybe the best example of this. There was a huge importation of demobilized Waffen-SS who were then injected into the local community, which already had, you know, benevolent organizations, labor temples. A lot of them were very pro-Bolshevik during the Bolshevik Revolution, and their politics sort of evolved out of that. So to erode that, you just put a bunch of, you know, and you also got to ask yourself, what class do the fascists usually come from? You know, they're usually educated, literate. They work bourgeois jobs, like a newspaper editor, you know,
for example. If I could pick one at random,
exactly. Yeah, and these people are injected into the community and get relative positions of power. A really good example of this, though, is the Inco nickel mine and smelter in Sudbury, Ontario. In 1993, the Ottawa Citizen filed freedom of information requests with the RCMP and dug up this massive 32-year-old report. And I'm reading from the Citizen right now. A 32-year-old RCMP report, which provides details about a riot that occurred outside Mine Mill Union Unions Hall in August 1961, says many of the rioters were former Nazi stormtroopers and, quote, Hungarian freedom fighters opposed to communism who had been imported by Inco. The report prepared by...
How come these freedom fighters... I was told that... That a freedom fighter would be against Nazis because they like free. This is all very, very unusual.
Yeah, it's very strange.
An anti-communist freedom fighter and a Nazi on the same side? Sorry, this is a bit far-fetched for me.
It's pretty wild. So the article quotes former president of Local 598, Mike Solsky, who says the RCMP did nothing to stop the riot aside from taking down a hammer and sickle flag one of the strikers had hung up and setting up roadblocks. So Mike goes on to describe his experience at work around the time, and he says, I remember a couple of guys who'd been in the army during the war. They were getting changed when they saw two...
Our army, I assume, right?
Yes. So they were getting changed when they saw two new workers who had SS tattoos. The other guy's army.
Oh, yeah. We shouldn't be trying to get those guys to move here because, you know, that's... Oh, wait, sorry. I should ask, did they say sorry?
They did not. No one said sorry. In fact,
they didn't say my bad.
No. So the non-SS tattooed workers beat the hell out of the SS tattooed workers, and Mike says we didn't see them around after that.
Yeah, well, that's because they couldn't debate their ideas.
Exactly. There was no forum for free debate after the beating.
Yeah. It is striking. I think this is something that's going to come up sort of over and over again as we go through this. Just the like the incredible cynicism of like of asking yourself, "Huh. Now am I going to, I don't know, slightly improve conditions for at work at this nickel smelter, or am I going to get into bed with the actual SS?" And yeah. Capital had a pretty easy choice in Germany. It's had a pretty easy choice in Canada here, sort of hiring a bunch of SS guys. And it always makes that choice, which is like, it can pay my employees, you know, 5 cents more an hour and like, you know, guarantee one fewer smelter maiming a month or whatever.
Yes.
Or I could hire these like, you know, Ustaza guys or what have you, who are going to come and like, you know, just who are literally going to be goose stepping and Roman saluting in my nickel smelter.
Yeah.
It's one or the other. And they always choose the latter.
Yeah. Would it surprise you to know that Inco has lost the documents, any documentation of hiring these workers?
What are you gonna keep documents the whole time? Come on, we're trying to go paperless.
Yeah, exactly.
In our transition to a paperless office, I'm afraid we've lost all those records of how we intentionally hired a bunch of Nazis to break this strike.
Yeah.
Here's a question. This is always like intelligence connected, right? Sort of these old rat lines that go to and from. That led out of like the sort of collapsed fascist regimes in Germany, right, to the nascent fascist regimes elsewhere.
Yeah, big capital starting up huge in the 1950s.
Big capital captured by the left, apparently.
Because
it went woke. They're importing Nazis and doing a pride flag. They went woke. I think the question, right, is also like the level of intelligence agency involvement, because like in the U.S., right, Operation Paperclip, it was an intelligence agency project. It was very much a government thing, whereas it seems sort of more freelance on our side, right?
Yeah, I mean, in Canada, it was kind of a coalescing of like a general idea that the Canadian leadership had, where they were, you know, and they still are beholden to major resource extraction companies. Like the fact that Inco was the second largest nickel mine in the world, nothing much has changed, really. Like, a lot of the pressure on Canada to sort of get involved in Venezuela and South America has to do with our, what, you know, one or two of the three mining companies in a trench coat that make this country up. Mm-hmm. And politicians are kind of beholden to them. On the intelligence side, a lot of, at least for the Ukrainian diaspora, a lot of this was helped by British intelligence. Mm-hmm. Who had all of the records of the people who were at the displaced persons camps in Europe. And our government liaison with British intelligence to essentially, you know, kind of filter out the ones that they wanted. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I do have to add, too, and I'm sure everybody knows this, that, you know, Canada did turn Jews away during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they were like, oh, we're not going to make that mistake again. Let in whoever wants to come in.
Yeah, exactly. They went too far in the other direction. They overcorrected. But what, you know, one arm of the government that was involved was, of course, the RCMP, who kind of worked in concert with this. And in the same article, it's revealed through FOIA documents that the RCMP had been monitoring the activity of Canadian citizens suspected of being communist or sympathetic to communism. Mm-hmm. And they infiltrated organizations they believed to be communist influenced. And one of their biggest targets was the International Union of Mine, Mill and Smelter Workers. Mm-hmm. And between 1937 and 1969, they amassed over 9,000 pages of surveillance documents. They were surveilling workers and their wives and children, and they had informants placed at almost every level of mine mill's activity. So one major success for RCMP penetration was through what are described in the documents as ethnic organizations. You know, where we could consider those like benevolent societies, community mm-hmm. groups that leaned super anti-communist.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, well, it's the... I mean, and the other thing, right, that I think is always important to remember when you're talking about stuff like this, is that if you confront a lot of Canadians with these facts, right, their reaction will be, "Wow, it sure was crazy when that happened."
Exactly.
In the past.
Exactly.
Right? Like it feels like history, and it's I think we've mentioned this in the past, but there is this. I think there is this drive, especially when looking at sort of the decision by sort of a lot of like big Western countries, Canada, the UK, US, wherever, to basically just accept heavily fascist-oriented shadow governments as just a fact of life for fighting communism, you know, that kind of thing. To just accept that as just something we have to do. There is this idea, I think, that ended in 1990, and that if you don't think that it just sort of hard stopped in the 1990s, then you're a conspiracy theorist, and yet it's still being covered up. It still takes FOIAs and lost documents, and it's very difficult, I think, to get people to understand like all of these isolated incidents aren't just one-offs that you can chalk up to just one of those things.
They're not just strange little quirks of history. They are. You know, they are the building blocks for something that is mutated into maybe an ideology that's less blunt, but is definitely more publicly accepted.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's it went from disrupting the sort of worker organizing and stuff. I mean, to all the way to like, you know, creating these conditions where social trust is you know, shattering and reduced simply because there is this secret shadow society, basically.
Yes, and they are
that is untouchable by democracy.
And they are very, very well organized. And, you know, as we'll kind of see in this series and even in this episode, these, and I like the idea of a shadow government, what, like these governments in exile, sometimes literally governments in exile. So just as an aside, the Victims of Communism Memorial, one of the supporters of this monument is the Belarusian government in exile, which is a non-recognized, non-national government in exile that started after the Bolshevik Revolution. You know, they've been around for over 100 years. The unrecognized Rada of Belarus. So those groups learned pretty quickly on that they had kind of a common goal, and they organized. And they organized very, very well. And they got to the point where, you know, now they're a considerable force in diverting public funds to things like, you know, sending material aid to Ukraine or putting troops on the ground in Latvia. I want to talk about Jim Tester, who was another union boss at the nickel mine. In this article, he recalls how some union members exposed an RCMP informant after that man had passed out drinking and a letter detailing a recent union meeting fell out of his pocket. I hate it when that happens. I hate it when I'm spying on the, when I'm a Hungarian fascist and I'm spying on the union and I have a little bit too much Unicum and then I just like fall down drunk and my spy letter falls out of my jacket pocket.
Yeah, the camera that I'm wearing in my gigantic hat runs out of tape and automatically opens. Ah, curses.
I especially hate it when that letter is addressed to a known Mountie. People find it, which is exactly what happened. Jim says, he said he had been doing it for 10 years. He was paid $160 a month. That was a lot of money back then, but he said he wasn't doing it for the money. He said he did it because he hated communism.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and also that gets to like, it gets to sort of the real sort of success of the sort of, you know, reactionary elements of the 20th century, right? Where, and this is still true today, where there is this idea, right, that you can just lump all of the world's evils into communism. And I mean, you know, it's ideology. It's what it's there for. It's what its function is. But sort of, I think like anti-communism was sort of such a foundational building block of society. It was such an integral thread to the social fabric of like paranoid Western countries or whatever. Mm-hmm. That it's what allows a weird sort of Bircherite Albertan fascist who like doesn't go into the city or whatever, yeah, to make a common cause with, you know, someone who owns, with one of the guys who's in charge of like Vale Mining or whatever.
Yeah,
these people.
Exactly.
But this idea that they are both share this same kind of paranoia, that they're willing to sort of almost, yeah, take these, you know, risks of spying and so on to fight just this thing that exists in their to fight their fantasies of, you know, social destruction. You know, yes. It is a war that is primarily fought. I mean, it's a war that is fought on battlefields, but it's a war that's fought in you know, union and labor temples and union halls on the factory floor. But also it's like, it must always be a paranoid fantasy of the reactionary. Constantly, and it must always be a paranoid fantasy.
Absolutely. And that fantasy has to be reinforced over and over and over again. Would it surprise you to know that the ideology behind equivocating communism and pure evil into totalitarianism is partially a brainchild of an Estonian German Canadian and was a Canadian project?
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, I'm just yet another great exile. Like, look, we have softwood lumber. We have nickel, mined and smelted, a couple of steps in the value chain.
We got fish.
We have fish. We have Rick Mercer. And
we have corner gas.
gas, Brent Butt. We have all that great stuff. And we also have just some of the single most like annoying ideologies to encounter on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely.
Just like, it's the guy, anyone who's like, actually, the Nazis were socialist. It makes them more like the communists than anyone else. Those annoying guys are a Canadian export.
Absolutely.
You're welcome, world.
Yes. So, one of the most successful exports, anti-communist exports that we've been responsible for is Black Ribbon Day, the holiday that everyone knows and loves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think it's actually getting too commercial. I'm concerned that it's just a Hallmark holiday now, Black Ribbon Day. After Hallmark, hired the members of the Catholic Falangist League of Czechia, they now just try to sell Black Ribbon Day cards.
Yeah, I like to celebrate Black Ribbon Day in the kind of old school way of just contemplating the equivalence of communism and Nazism and tweeting as much as possible and yelling at people about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
My favorite way to celebrate Black Ribbon Day is with my family of fellow industrialists and defense mandarins. It's sitting in a smoke-filled room in D.C., not saying that we have to kill Kennedy, but heavily implying that it would be good if someone was out of the way and Lyndon Johnson could get us our war.
Yes.
Me and the CEO of Bell Helicopter just send each other a nice card that is written on a human vellum.
Yeah. With the blood of the workers.
Mm-hmm.
So Black Ribbon Day is the brainchild of Marcus Hess, and it's a day of remembrance for, quote, victims of totalitarian regimes, specifically Stalinist, communist, Nazi, and fascist regimes. And mm-hmm. here we have to stop and ask, what is the point of the term totalitarianism?
Well, I think, like, right, it's one of the things that liberalism does, I think, is because liberalism sort of... Liberalism is at its politically strongest when it has no definition, when it can just say liberalism is everything that's good and everything that's bad is because liberalism has been betrayed in some way. Right.
Yes.
So, you know, you can see it most in the kind of, you know, like let's think about like a free market ideologue, like a Koch brother or whatever, for example. It is unarguable that in America, and I use an American example just because the healthcare situation is sort of so cut and dried there. It's good for as an example. A Koch brother is able to say, well, yeah, of course, you know, the healthcare situation in America is bad because we don't have enough liberalism. We don't have enough free markets about it. There's too much regulation. There are too many laws. You know, you're not allowed to have doctors get into a bidding war to take out your pancreas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't shop around enough to get your burst appendix removed. So there is that argument. And I think you can... And what liberalism does in that argument is it makes itself invisible. It does not say the function liberalism performs, except maybe restating some of its base assumptions, like liberalism is like a free market is good because people make free choices and those free choices add up, blah, 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 blah. And those free choices are prima facie good, etc. And I think much in the same way here, you know, you're able to say, well, there are normal regimes which are liberal, mm-hmm. and then there are bad regimes which are illiberal or totalitarian. And it's basically able to be mutually exclusive and completely exhaustive from the point of view of liberalism.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And it allows liberalism to, or many liberal democracies to excuse many of their own, say, failures on their own terms, so to speak, by suggesting that, well, that these things that must be done, so like, you know, illegal invasion of Iraq or whatever, it's because we are fighting totalitarianism, we are fighting to defend liberalism, blah, blah, blah. And what happens is you end up, as once you become a sort of a critic of liberalism in this way, you sort of end up looking in real and realizing, oh, well, actually, you know, this is, I mean, many of the ways in which you might want to define totalitarianism, we're kind of doing a lot of those just, you know, maybe more subtly and say maybe we're doing a lot of them to other people elsewhere. you know, but
yeah,
we are, it is one of these situations where you can look at it and say, oh, we are actually little better. But the concept of totalitarianism lets us draw that big, bright line between us and the bad guys,
mm-hmm.
and lets us justify whatever we need to do in order to stay on the right side of that line.
I think it's telling, too, that that these nationalist communities in exile, right? These sort of self-appointed shadow governments of a state that was, you know, in their mind, not allowed to exist for 40 or 50 years, you know, until the fall of communism, that they would prefer fascism, really? Because that's where their ideology is at.
Yeah.
It's ethno-nationalist. They would prefer fascism, but they'll take liberalism.
Well, yeah, because liberalism does it, liberalism is very good at letting you be fascist so long as you stay good mannered.
Exactly.
You know?
And
it's
also,
why, like, fucking 20% of the population of Madrid is fully Francoista.
Exactly.
Like, if you go into like a sort of an upper class Spanish person's house in Madrid, like, you will see a bust of Hitler in there.
Yeah, it's kind
chances
of the,
are you will.
It's and kind of the same I'm in the north of speaking, Italy too, like the northern,
also,
league,
even,
northern league.
I'm not even speaking in I'm not even speaking in theoreticals here. Like, I have a friend of mine, he went into like one guy's house in Spain. This like yeah, super upper class dude, and you know it was there a bust of Mussolini, Hitler, and Franco in their dining room.
Yeah,
right. This is it. Liberal societies are fantastic at permitting fascists to be fascist explicitly, so long as they're not impolite and déclassé.
Exactly. And this kind of equivocation, it also works really well for memory politics, which has become, you know, a major battleground against between sort of left and center right, far right, mm-hmm. especially in the last 10 years.
It's one. It's again, and by making by drawing all of these equivalences, you can try and create political third rails. And when you look at what you're actually trying to sort of make into a political third rail, you know, I mean, I trust me, I saw it happen here in the UK. you end up making sort of, you know, very basic social democracy into a political third rail because the sort of fascist project of rewriting history, or the kind of late period fascist project, post World War II fascist project of rewriting history to make all of these things equivalent, is a scorched earth fight.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
Any liberal who makes common cause with these people is always ends up regretting doing so because. Because ascent there is you can't just use them you cannot use them, they always use you.
Yep.
Basically.
Yep. And we're gonna see this like basically right here. So the narrative of Black Ribbon Day goes kind of as far as possible in this direction, the direction we've been talking about. It basically suggests that fascism and communism have to take equal blame in starting the Second World War. You know, totally ignoring the fact that these two groups were diametrically opposed to each other, and that it was Russian communists and domestic local partisans who fucking rinsed the Nazis and basically liberated huge swaths of Europe.
Well, it's also that famous Martin Niemöller poem, right? Right. It was a part of this effort was about rewriting that poem. To rewrite the first line from "First they came for the communists," which is what the first line was, to "First they came for the socialists."
Exactly.
To soften that, if you want to talk politics of memory, and drawing sort of and begin laying the groundwork for those equivalencies, there it is. There that is right there.
Yes.
You know, and equally right, like it also means that you have to, if you're going to make that claim, you have to like. Kind of forget that a big part of what the Nazis were doing was they were trying to imitate European, they were trying to do European colonial politics on all the bits of Europe that were east of them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And they saw like, you know, like Slavic countries as terrorists, like they had all of that ideology prepared. Like it wasn't that it wasn't, but the a conception of this that is sort of, I think, quite acceptable to liberals and willing to be, again, like, weaponized by fascists who know that, like, the Nazis were the official bad guys, and so you have to, like, shape your story thusly, is that, oh, they're all equally responsible because they were illiberal and they couldn't decide how to be illiberal, and so they had to fight amongst themselves in the world to decide how illiberal to be.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And this this project was a worldwide project. It wasn't you know, it wasn't just isolated to a single group here or another group there. So the emigre groups that spread Black Ribbon Day across Canada and then out to the rest of the world were linked and supported by pro-fascist revanchist movements. So you've got the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, mm-hmm. World Anti-Communist League, and then the CIA-funded Captive Nations programs. Mm-hmm. So these groups, you know, they started sort of disconnected, but then attracted far-right lobby groups, mainstream politicians, and then finally, everyone's favorite, mass media, started supporting them. And this is a progression that is repeated with the evolution of the, you know, the sad story of the Victims of Communism Memorial in Canada here.
Yeah.
But you could...
I say more,
oh, go ahead.
More tied to that... shares a similar history with that other memorial that was in the news a couple of years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Would it surprise you to know that the subject of the other memorial that was in the news is also takes up a brick in the Victims of Communism
Memorial? Sorry,
you
can't protest that because it's a hate crime for some reason.
Yeah, that's right. So you can see this intersectionalism at work in the case of the Canadian Polish Congress, who in 2014 they wrote a book on Black Ribbon Day, and that book heaps praise on the Canadian Polish Congress's right-wing efforts to subdue and discipline Canada's left-wing Polish groups. This is what we were talking about before, the sort of importation of fascists to discipline the local leftists who have already been in country for a while. CPC Manitoba President Sophia DeWitt is quoted in the book as saying, being communist is the worst sin you could commit.
Yep, certainly that would be the worst thing that happened in the 20th century. Can't think of anything else, you know, that could consider, could count as a worse sin. Uh-huh. It was that Workers' Council that ran that factory, for sure.
That's right. They built the smokestacks. So the ironic thing is that, like, the CPC has received $988,000 in government grants through Canadian state socialism, supporting diasporas.
Awesome. That's great. It's great that, you know, that those public education grants are going to those groups. I can't wait to be educated by them. About, you know, the history of the 20th century. Who was the good guys? Who was the bad guys? What was World War II really fought over? Et cetera, et cetera, et
cetera. I can't wait to hand in my book report on the philosophy of Dr. Ante Pavelich. But I want to talk a little bit about, you know, how Black Ribbon Day got started. Like you know, the early days, the demo tapes.
Yeah, that's right.
As it were. The first 7-inch.
Yeah, the old school Black Ribbon Day, before it became about the money, it was about the doctrinaire anti-communism.
That's
yeah,
right.
then they put that speech by that Sturmbannfuhrer into an iPod commercial, and they sold out.
Yeah, exactly. Back when Marcus Hess was touring Central Europe in a van, just, you know, eating rider food. Eating whatever Radio Free Liberty would give him after his taping. So Hess started Black Ribbon Day in 1985 when he pitched the idea to the Toronto-based Estonian Central Council, a group whose early leadership was stacked with Nazi collaborators, including former officers of the Estonian Waffen-SS. And the ECC is ideologically linked to SD Vabadulsilat, which was formed in Berlin on February 5th, 1945, mm-hmm. by SS Obersturm von Fuhrer.
No. Oh, no.
Harold Reepaloo and Ayn Irvin Mayer. So there you have it. Hess planned to unite what he called captive national groups by using an annual protest to focus public attention on anti-Soviet fears. Mm-hmm. He got himself elected to the ECC board, and he presented his plan to the group's annual meeting, which gave Black Ribbon Day the green light. Hess then formed an alliance with leadership from other Nazi collaborators, including the Lithuanian-Canadian community, not the actual community, but that's what the sort of right-wing group was called, the Lithuanian-Canadian community, mm-hmm. and Latvian National Federation in Canada. Mm-hmm. And they called this group the Group of Seven.
Oh, yeah. So that was, what, Lismer, Varley, Carmichael, Lord Harris, that bunch? Yeah, yeah.
No. Yeah, it's Czechoslovakia, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine.
My great-grandparents were early patrons of these Latvian artists. Group of Seven.
So BRD gets its big break. Like
in my great-grandparents' dining room, they actually had a painting of the Croatian Volk reaching its full potential.
Oh, man, dobro. So BRD gets its big break. Like, basically, it's it's showcase show with all the big label execs there. When Hess meets Yaroslav Sokolik, who is the president of the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress, and they meet at an ECC event. So this led to Hess presenting his plans to the Toronto-based World Congress of Free Ukrainians, and Sokolik becomes the co-chair of the Black Ribbon Day Committee.
That sounds like it has such a fucking... What a fucking fun organization to go hang out at, like, because that's the thing that also, like, what they're either meeting usually in community halls, but then if they have a national meeting, what are they going to, like, an airport ramada?
Like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, these early meetings must have been pretty fucking grim. Like, so just to explain the World Congress of Ukrainians, this organization is notable for being the biggest umbrella group for Ukrainian far-right diaspora orgs, and B, absolutely in love with Stepan Bandera.
Now, for new listeners, for those listeners out there who might not be familiar with Stepan Bandera and Banderaism in general, can you give us, like, a quick run-through? Let's do this. Let's compare and contrast, you know, for 30 marks in the final exam.
All right, so Bandera is the sort of primo Ukrainian nationalist. He is deeply a fascist. Mm-hmm. During the Second World War, he was usually on the side of the Nazis, occasionally not on the side of the Nazis, but generally, and which is kind of a wedge that allows Ukrainian nationalists to say Bandera wasn't a fascist. He was deeply anti-Semitic. He believed in an ethnically pure Ukraine.
Believed in an ethnic and a Ukraine that he would say was ethnically pure. A massive anti-Semite. Frequently allied himself with the Nazis, but no, you have to. You cannot say, of course, he was actually a Nazi because of this little fig leaf. Anyway, the important thing to remember about Stepan Bandera is that he was completely fucking owned by the KGB in 59.
Yeah, absolutely.
Got his ship wrecked.
I think they assassinated him with this, like, air dispersal cyanide gun.
Yeah, when they were doing fucking Bond shit in the mid-20th century.
Exactly. Like, real high point for the KGB. Yeah. Owned. Yes. So Sokolik joining
Of course, you don't forget, he has been awarded the title of Hero of Ukraine.
Yes. Also to note, his fucking grandson lives in Ontario and posts frequently on Twitter about, I'd say 90% of his posts are about Ukraine and Ukrainian nationalism, and 10% are him complaining about the Ontario DMV.
Yeah, I mean that tracks for, you know, like there are two ways. If you're like the if you are the Canadian progeny of a fascist, there are kind of two ways your career goes. One is you become a massive crank who's just like angry at like the Department of Health or whatever for some inscrutable reason because they're like telling you to like, you know, like clean up your yard or whatever. You're furious with Ontario Power Generation because you think somehow you're not getting the good stuff, like that kind of thing. You become someone who yells at the DMV, like you become evil Fed smoker, or you just get a mainstream job in politics.
Exactly. And you start writing foreign policy. Maybe you'll even become the Minister of Foreign Affairs.
Come on. That's pretty far-fetched.
So Sokolic adds this weight of like an organized worldwide movement to Hess's cause. And these groups begin spreading the gospel of Black Ribbon Day. But pretty soon, the Black Ribbon Day Committee realizes that they can't achieve their goals with just the limited resources of embittered diaspora anti-communist organizations. So they begin to reach outside of the community, and they strike gold with the National Citizens Coalition. Mm-hmm. The NCC was one of Canada's most powerful far-right forces. Harper would chair it from 1998 to 2002. And Hess found a great friend in its president, David Somerville, a man who is always photographed with what I am going to call a restraining order mustache, or maybe school zone mustache is a better description. Hess would call David a brother in arms, and David would contribute the NCC's office space and resources to Black Ribbon Day's cause.
I think one of the things we should also do, right, is there is this history. There is this very specific history behind this holiday, right? This Hallmark holiday. And I think it also, like, so a lot of what they do really is, most of what they actually seem to do is just, like, publish a number where, you know, anytime someone, like, stubbed their toe in, you know, 1920s Russia, they're going to add, like, you know, like, break out another thousand. Onto the you know, like Black Book of Communism list of deaths, right?
Tally sheet. Yeah,
like that's mostly, as far as I can tell, that seems to basically just be what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's kind of explained in this quote from Somerville from that same book that the CPC put out. So he's talking about this initial planning meeting he has with Hess, and he says about that meeting, "It was a revelation to use the public's pre-existing revulsion for the Nazis to get them to feel similarly towards the Soviet communists. In condemning both of the regimes simultaneously, it will be impossible for critics to attack us as right-wing extremists or Nazi sympathizers." And I think that's the point of this whole thing.
If you're going to be an anti-communist, because, like, if you sort of almost want to walk back to first principles, right? The reason that there is communism is that there are these contradictions of bourgeois society. There are these things that make it impossible for workers to live like lives of dignity or whatever, right? And I think, you know, it's not, that is just the simple, it is baked into that relationship of production between the employer and the employee. It is baked into the workplace. You cannot, you could not change it without fundamentally altering society, right? And there is, and that contradiction produces problems, it produces symptoms, their rate of profit has a tendency to fall, etc., etc., etc. So these problems must be, and these problems are all collective action problems. And the reason I think that you will always have fascists in anti-communist organizations is because both fascism and communism are answers to a collective action problem, one along class lines and one along the lines of, you know, racial destiny or whatever you want to call it, national destiny, etc. And the first one is collective action of all of the of a collective action problem that is solved by people on one side who are getting the raw end of the deal of the capitalist relations of production. And the collective action problem on the other side, on the fascist side, is solved by a national rather than class solidarity to essentially force a non-favored, most of the workers who are non-favored, it's an alliance between the ruling class and a favored section of the working class to basically crush the rest of it, right? And thereby, thereby sort of, at least from their point of view, solving that collective action problem. And the reason that being anti-communist liberals will never be able to not ally with, you know, fascists or fascist sympathizers or the far right or whatever, is because liberals have no answer to that collective action problem. You know,
they absolutely do not.
And so if your priority is to crush the sort of, you know, organic worker organizing that's happening, say, in your nickel mine, then you need someone with an answer to that collective action problem. And so it's easier for capital, as liberal and nice and polite as it wants to be, it's easier for capital to turn to the fascist answer to that collective action problem because they don't have to give up any of their power, or at least they don't think they will.
Fascists always have an answer to communism.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, it's, and so that's why I think that gets to the heart of why, you know, an anti-communist crusade of some kind, it is going, if you dig far enough, you're going to at least find a lot of, you might say, softening of fascism, for example, by like equating it with communism is just one thing that you could do, or even just like understanding sort of, you know, Nazi puppet regimes in Eastern Europe as, oh, actually they were doing the best they could, or they were sort of, you know, they thought they had to cooperate with Hitler, et cetera, rewriting all these bits of history. And at the end of the day, right, it just comes down to that one brute fact, that thing you can't move or change, which is that this is that capitalism generates a problem that requires a solution that is based on collective action, and you need to pick one side of that solution. You can't just do nothing, because then someone else will do something. And yeah, like I said, right, like it is easier on a short-term basis for a company or for a liberal society that sort of takes this idea of totalitarianism seriously. It is easier for them to, you know, get into bed with either fascists or fascist sympathizers, or even just in its softest formulation, you know, people who are soft on fascism.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And for a lot of the fascists employed in carrying out this project, this is where a long view of history is important. This is where these things, like we said at the beginning, aren't just disconnected events, right? So for these fascists to carry this out, we need to look at their efforts as an extremely effective long game continuation of anti-Soviet guerrilla fighting, like literal guns and bombs fighting.
With guerrillas.
And with guerrillas. Yeah. Sometimes, and sometimes, you know, in even in the case of Black Ribbon Day, and definitely in the case of the Inco, you know, labor suppression, it's being carried out by the same people who were fighting communists with guns and bombs.
And the thing is, right, fighting for the fascist solution to the collective action problem of capitalism and decay, right? Like that's it. It comes down to these unavoidable facts that a propaganda organization is minded to obscure.
Yeah, yeah. So Black Ribbon Day would officially be adopted almost 20 years later. Basically, the 1990s had a cooling effect on Black Ribbon Day's efforts in that, you know, the Soviet Union fell, all these Eastern Bloc countries went through these convulsive shock doctrine lurches towards capitalism, and this anti-communist movement was kind of set adrift for a while, but...
And it would never come back because capitalism would never have any problems with it. Nope. That collective action problem would never need to be solved again by some kind of, well, it would take some kind of a financial crisis in order to make it rear its ugly head.
Which is exactly what happened. It was the end of history, and then history started up again. So the president of the European Parliament, Hans-Gert Pottering, whose father, incidentally, died fighting on the side of the Nazis, put this motion forward. It was adopted by a unanimous vote in the European House of Commons. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the ideology of Black Ribbon Day has shifted a little bit in recent years, with the European Parliament signing in a 2019 resolution that, quote, highlights the importance of Black Ribbon Day in pushing back against the Russian information war waged against democratic Europe. So mm-hmm. they have gone from equivocating Nazism and communism to equivocating the Soviet Union with modern capitalist Russia under Putin.
Yeah, Comrade Browder's country.
Yeah, Comrade Browder. It's funny how that works, yeah, you know? This is a special magic trick you can apply to any of your enemies, mm-hmm. really.
Yeah, you just have to say that they're the bad guy, because that's what it always just sort of really... That's how it was always used in public, is bad guys. Like, you're on the side of the bad guys? You can't be on the side of the bad guys. They want bad things to happen to good people. We want good things to happen to good people and bad things to happen to bad people. Incidentally, don't look up what any of us or our families were doing in the 30s and 40s.
Exactly. And speaking of that, you know, we got to ask, where are we now? Like, how do we as Canadians celebrate this most solemn of holidays? And speaking of people who had family members doing things in the 30s and 40s, in 2016, Chrystia Freeland tweeted out one of my favorite tweets, one of her best, I think, top three.
How could
three.
You choose?
I know, there's just so many good ones. August 23rd, 2016, Chrystia says, thinking of my grandparents, Mihailo and Alexandra Chomiak, on Black Ribbon Day, they were forever grateful to Canada for giving them refuge, and they worked hard to return freedom and democracy to Ukraine. Uh-huh. I'm proud to honor their memory uh-huh. today.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Is this something we will explore in a part two of this series on Maple Gladio?
Yes, yes. So stay tuned for part two and a deep dive into how Chrystia Freeland's family was spreading freedom and democracy.
Absolutely. And just in case anyone's wondering, my stomach feels a little better because I drank a big bottle of sparkling water.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how your tummy was doing after all this. This is kind of a sour episode, Riley. So, you know, there's a lot to chew on and digest.
I'm all puckered up. I'm making a big kissy face, like I've just sucked on a warhead, and my stomach. But my stomach feels better. So, you know, I think everything worked out okay.
So, you know, because you are, out of all the people I know, you are a victim of podcasting.
Yeah, they need to add my stomachache to the Black Book of Communism.
It's true. I want to release you from this gulag.
Yeah, well, I think that about does it for part one of this exploration. And Dan, I want to say thanks to you, actually, for steeping your brain in this maple-flavored poison for the last, like, 5 years.
I feel completely insane, but I'm actually really glad that I have an outlet now where I can compile my research and talk about this and not just completely punish my partner by... appearing around a corner and bombarding her with facts about Ukrainian Nazis.
All right. So I think that's about it. Thank you very much for listening to The Bottleman. And we will see you on the bonus episode in a couple of days, where we're going to talk about some of the life and career of Rob Ford with Seeking Derangements' Palma.
Hell yes.
It's going to be a lot of fun. So we'll see you there. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, $7 Canadian a month, you get a second episode every week.
Also, we love you.
And we'll also love you and be your friend in real life, and it'll make my stomach feel better.
Yeah.
All right.
Slava Bottleman.
Later, everyone.
Bye.